WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In William Gibson's science fiction, the setting is a barren post-World War III world where multinationals have taken the place of political systems. Computer hackers vie for power in a computer-generated zone known as cyberspace. Gibson has consciously put into his science fiction references to rock and roll, consumer culture, and modern art, just the sort of stuff he missed in the science fiction he read growing up. With his first novel, Neuromancer, William Gibson became known as the father of a new wave of science fiction that's been called cyberpunk. William Gibson's new novel is titled Mona Lisa Overdrive, and it's set sometime in the future.
Well, you know, I deliberately hedged on that. I would guess from internal evidence that it's sort of the mid-21st century. So what's that, like 60 years?
Uh-huh.
It's not very far away, but it's not... While there's a convention in science fiction that one is writing about the future, no one can really write about the future, and I think that science fiction novels, by and large, reflect the decade that they were created in. You know, the 50s SF, you look at it, and it's the 50s. And I started doing the kind of work I'm doing because I wanted something that reflected the 70s, and everything I was reading that was being written then seemed to me to reflect the 60s.
Well, now it's the 80s. How are you doing?
Well, I've sort of reached the, in a way, I've reached the limit of the material. Like, things have changed so much. When I wrote Neuromancer, my first novel, it was, I didn't know about AIDS. Nobody had heard of that. I knew vaguely about the greenhouse effect, but I didn't think it was going to be anything to worry about. And nobody had told me that the ozone layer was decaying. So in a sense, my imaginary future is already obsolete. So I'm going to, you know, the next time around, I'm going to have to go back and take all those things into consideration.
Your book is set after the wars. What wars did you envision, and what were they fought over?
Well, that's a very optimistic little piece of trickery on my part, because I wanted to be able to write about a future, and I wanted to be able to say, well, it's there. So I posited, as a sort of piece of background information, one very, very brief nuclear exchange that results in the whole world saying, oh no, we've got to get rid of these things, and then it's, you know, then you have a future. But, you know, we should be so lucky, probably.
Multinationals play a pretty important role in your books.
I think I originally may have gotten that from Thomas Pynchon's view of the Royal Dutch Shell Company in Gravity's Rainbow, which is the first time I realized that there were companies that could operate on both sides of the Second World War and merge seamlessly, you know, afterwards. And still, you know, these are entities that are outside national boundaries, and that's always fascinated me. I think multinationals, in a sense, are like more evolved life forms.
Describe your cyberspace matrix.
Oh, that's a tough one on that's a tough one off the page. I've posited a level of technology in which people can experience media a bit more efficiently than we can today, so that rather than having to look at a television set and put on the earphones, you simply plug yourself into something that makes you feel that you are in the environment that the media producer has generated. So taking that as a given, and that's an old idea from science fiction. In the 50s, they called that feelies in science fiction. Taking that as a given, I've coupled that with computer technology to try to imagine a world in which computer operators enter into what I've only ever been able to describe as a consensual hallucination.
You've been credited with revitalizing science fiction. When you started writing, did you think of science fiction as needing revitalizing?
Yeah, well, to answer that in two parts, I've been, I may have been credited with it, would that it were true. I wish science fiction, you know, had been revitalized, but I did deliberately set out, in an odd sort of way, I didn't set out to be successful at this. I was with my early short stories in the first book, and in a way I was writing things that I thought would bug the science fiction community to no end, and I thought, well, this book's going to be ignored. because I was tired of, I don't know, I was tired of unicorn fantasies, and I was tired of this sort of endlessly recycled pseudo-Heinleinian stuff, you know, male power fantasies, and the future is the United States, and you know, the sort of things that are being produced by the writers my friend Bruce Sterling likes to call Reagan youth. So I thought, I'm going to come in here and, you know, do the old, you know, put the double whammy on this stuff. But consequently, I expect it to be roundly ignored.
Well, what's an example of something that you thought would really bug other science fiction writers?
Well, for instance, the it's impossible on internal evidence, when you read my novel Neuromancer, to determine whether or not the United States exists as a political entity. And you're aware of large corporations, and people have neighborhoods and teenage street gangs, and there's cities or possibly city-states, and certain cities have merged, you know, Boston, Atlanta, and New York are all part of the same big ugly thing. But you can't tell if the United States exists. And I thought that alone was, you know, that alone was done in deliberate reaction to this overwhelming tendency in American science fiction to see the future as America. And I think at one time the world believed that America was the future, but now the future's gone somewhere else, perhaps to Japan. It's probably on its way to Singapore soon, but I think, you know, I don't think we're it anymore.
You're writing the screenplay for Aliens 3, and you're writing screenplays for a couple of your own short stories.
Yeah.
Are you going to treat technology differently in movies than you do in books once you have the chance to, you know, get people to actually build these things that you've only imagined and described on paper?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think I have basically, you know, for that matter, I'm not really sure how it is I do treat technology, but it's amazing, you know, how quickly this stuff develops. So I met some computer special effects people the last time I was in Hollywood, and they said, oh, we want to do cyberspace for you. This is what it looks like. And they started showing me things on monitor screens that, you know, that I couldn't believe. And I said, you can do it. It's almost here. And they said, oh, yeah, definitely. It's going to be we're going to be able to do this in a couple of years, but we just want to fake it right now for the movie so we can do it with this.
You've imagined levels of technology that we have not reached yet. Are you a technologically adept person yourself?
No, I'm not. I'm a sort of generalist, and I think that's...
Does that mean you know how to use a toaster? What does that mean, being a generalist?
Well, I know how to use a toaster, and I know how to use a relatively primitive word processor, and I know how to use a telephone, but not the really complicated modern ones. But I don't have any specific area of technical expertise, and I think in fact the reason I was able to get away with what I did in Neuromancer is that I knew virtually nothing about computers. So I sort of imagined what, not only what computers would be, but I imagined what they are, because I had no hands-on experience. And I did that through some strange process of decoding what I took to be the rather poetic language of the hackers, and words like interface, you know, sort of leaking into, you know, common usage, and you know, that's a lovely word, and I thought, what does that mean? So I make up something.
Do you like words like interface? I mean, a lot of people hate words like that because it's...
Oh, I think it's the cutting edge of language, really.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's one of the points in English where language is evolving, and language is constantly changing.
Well, your books have added a word to the language in a way. Your books have been named cyberpunk. What do you think of that new word?
Well, that's one I could have done without, but that's a very mysterious word. We're still trying to find out who introduced it. It definitely wasn't one of the participants in this alleged literary movement or phenomena or whatever it is. But I suppose, in a way, it's reasonably descriptive. Although I don't know what people would think of it when they see it. I mean, if I didn't know what it was supposed to mean, I would think it would mean some guy in a mohawk. It's like modems and mohawks or something. A guy with a mohawk and a Mac 2. And that, I don't know, that wasn't what I had in mind. I just thought, when I started out doing this stuff, I thought I was trying to do what I thought I was being a slightly hipper kind of science fiction.
Well, Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
William Gibson's new novel, Mona Lisa Overdrive, is published by Bantam Books. This is Fresh Air.